Goeiedag en hartelijk welkom bij Regheid met Robinson hier op Plitnet. Ons is zelfs met Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman, die man wat al amper 3 dekades aan die stuur staan van Gift of the Givers. Dit is de grootste hulpverleningsorganisatie in Afrika. Hy het in die tijd al bij die 3,5 miljard rand bestee aan verschillende projecten. En sy doel is om hoop te gee en waardigheid te herstel. Gift of the Givers het verskeie internationale prijzen verover vir sy onbaatzuchtige dienst en 9 eredoktorsgrade is aan Dr. Suleiman toegekend. Het is een voorrecht om Dr. Suleiman als gast te verwelkom. Welkom, dokter. Nice speaking to you as always.
We've seen a long time again.
Yes. We've seen some dramatic scenes in Kabul, in Afghanistan, in the past few days of people who are so desperate to run away from the Taliban that has taken over in Kabul that they even hang on to an aircraft taking off. Now, have you had any calls or requests to be involved in that situation to help the refugees?
Well, initially the calls came from 2 or 3 media only. They said they know we got involved in situations like these. And I made it very clear since COVID started last year, you know, on the 15th of March, that we're not getting involved in any international missions because all our teams are needed in the country, given the great health burden and the challenges in our country. Having said that, I subsequently then got a message from somebody who said there's 16 pilots from some company stuck in Kabul. And after a discussion later on last night, I was told that there are people stuck in various parts of Afghanistan. So I'm talking specifically about South Africans now. And they're not all in Kabul and they need to get to Kabul. And my initial suggestion was, of course, go to Durko and look at getting to Pakistan. And then after a while reflecting on it, I realized, you know what? The guys who got a very good influence on the Taliban and in Afghanistan are the Qatari government. And also, if you have to bring South Africans back, it'll be easier to bring them on Qatar Airways because Qatar Airways still has a regular flight schedule to South Africa, which many airlines don't have because of the COVID-19 situation. So last night, we got hold of the Qatari ambassador. He's new in the country. It's a long story how we got to him. But he said, look, he can help. He's willing to help. But what we do need first is the names of all the South Africans trapped inside Afghanistan, the ID numbers, or the passport numbers for this matter, and where they're based. And if we give that to him first on our letterhead, he will look at sending an urgent message with a motivation to the Qatar government in Doha. That's where it starts off with. And so we said, look, that's the first aspect. Can you assist? And he said, locate them, let me know how many they are, and we can, that's the first part. The second part we're requesting, we haven't done it directly yet in writing, is to ask if Qatar government can facilitate using Qatar Airways to bring them down. Because the Qatari government is known to be generous. They've assisted in many hostage situations. They've arranged for other governments to get the hostages home from Mali and other places. So they are known to be generous when it comes to situations like these. And of course, it's a very expensive business. Given all the flight insurance, airlines are closing, nobody's sure what's going to happen. So it'll be advantageous if they agree, both in terms of facilitating the process of getting safe passage from everywhere in Afghanistan to Kabul, and from there using their own airline to bring them to Doha and to South Africa. It's a shot in the dark. There's no guarantee it will work, but it's something we want to, we have opened a dialogue with them last night, but we can't do anything until we have names and passport numbers. You know, and where the people are based in Afghanistan. So we actually need the public to respond to us.
Let me be a little bit personal and forgive me for being so, but you are a Muslim yourself. What is your basic reaction in your heart about what's happening in Afghanistan?
It's too early to say. You know, we judge any Muslim country, well, not the Muslim country, I mean, the country is only the buildings. It's the behavior of people. It's too early to say yet, you know what, are they following Islamic law or not? Islamic law protects all rights. It, you know, it protects women, it protects children, it protects elderly, it protects even enemies. It protects people you're at war with. It emphasizes peace, it emphasizes dialogue, it emphasizes reduction of bloodshed. What we can say is that they have a huge support in Afghanistan. The Taliban have a huge support in Afghanistan. If you're comparing to what they were 20 years ago, I think it's different. You know, you need to give them time because there's a new generation, there's new blood, there's new thinking. It's too early to say. It may be just now for the media or for the, you know, for the public consumption. When they start implementing their laws, we'll see that then. I don't think they've attacked anybody or harmed anybody. So there's South African voice notes coming from there to say they are in the streets, but they haven't harmed anybody, that they themselves are safe in the hotel, except they're feeling very uncomfortable being there and they want to be back home. So what are we seeing is on media, I can't actually say until days pass and we evaluate them based on how they conduct themselves according to Islamic teachings.
Well, you mostly deal with disasters, natural disasters, when you're asked to go and help when there's an earthquake, for instance, as you did in Iran. But it seems to me that globally, there's an increasing trend towards disasters caused by politicians. Is that also a feeling that you get?
Well, our first project was involved in the Bosnia War. Give us the grace to give us first project. Our initial start off was the intervention in the Bosnia War in Europe. And after that, we've been in other wars. We've been in Iraq, we've been in Lebanon, we've been in Gaza, we've been in Syria, we've assisted Rwanda. So we've been involved in many conflict situations created by men. So it's not something new. And of course, in recent years, in 2014, we got involved in a hostage situation, you know, getting Yolande Corky out of Yemen. And we secured Pierre Corky's release. And on the morning of 6 December, the day he was going to come out, he died when the American troops went in. And both he and Luke Summers died. And subsequently, we got involved with Stephen, and Johan Gustafsson, Stephen McGowan, and Johan Gustafsson from Sweden. And we have been asked to assist with many other hostage situations by other countries. So it's war situations and hostage situations where the involvement is armed groups, you know, groups with very dangerous, but we've succeeded, you know, in giving advice, assisting governments in getting their people out.
And then we had our own experience here in South Africa in the past 2 weeks or so of looting in absolute chaos caused by our own people. And the idea is that perhaps there was something behind it, some political kind of campaign against the current government. Was that your impression as well?
Yes, I read it as there was four elements involved in this campaign. Number one, those who were the pro-Zuma supporters. And I mean, everybody has a right to be pro somebody. I have no issue with that. The issue I had was, when you take it further, there were looters. But of course, if you look at it, many of them were very ordinary people, not violent, not dangerous. If you see them going to the shops and coming out, a lot of them greeted you. They came out with a packet of chicken or some tin fish or whatever and took it and they took the kids with them. Students went in. None of them actually were violent. You know, they were very, very peaceful, and we watched that. The danger was the people who came after them, those who came deliberately to burn the buildings. And this thing wasn't planned on the 11th of July or the 8th of July. It was planned way beyond that. Because once meeting people and speaking to companies, we realized they targeted specific warehouses in specific places and left the other ones behind. They knew exactly what stock was in which warehouse and where. Those ones specifically were targeted and others were left behind. They knew which malls to hit, which shopping centers to strike, which pharmaceutical wholesalers to destroy, which pharmacies to affect, which doctors' practices, which opticians to affect. So this was the third group, the ones that burnt. But even those, to me, were just being used. And when you put it all together, you realize that the people who wanted to create an impression that the country was in turmoil had no numbers. And the only way to get numbers was to call people to help themselves from shops. And when you do that, and when people are in a poverty-stricken situation, although many of those who looted were not in the poverty situation because of so many Kumbis and Buckies and Mercedes and BMWs to come, means more stuff was taken by those who were more well-off than those who were less well-off. Because to move such expensive and heavy equipment required somebody who had vehicles. And surely the poor people who have nothing to eat don't even have those kind of vehicles or money to pay for that kind of transport. So it was to create the idea there was a mass insurrection. It wasn't. It was freebies, it was opportunism. So they needed to create the numbers and create the impression that the country is under violent unrest. It wasn't. The real problem was the fourth category of people. And to me, those are the ones who instigated all this. And to them, I call them traitors. They are anti-patriotic. Because who did they affect? If they're saying they're working in the interests of the people of South Africa and the black people, who was affected the most? So many black centers were affected. 45 black opticians were affected. It's so hard to put one black child through university. It's a lot of sacrifice. coming to the rural areas, putting them to a school. They speak the vernacular language or the ethnic language. They come to university. It's English-based medium. It's difficult to understand what's being said in English because we haven't learned. It's not any short of capacity. The language is a problem. If I study in an English medium school and go to a Zulu university, I'll have the same problem. I won't understand what they're talking about. And I won't be able to grasp what's being taught. And under all those circumstances, these kids became optometrists. And then, worst of all, doctors and nurses cannot get to public hospitals. Now, who are the main patients in public hospitals? They're Black. So actually, you are responsible for making sure that that Black people in hospitals are not getting oxygen. And I would call the hospital to say, we have a problem getting oxygen to our people. We cannot feed them. We cannot get medicines to them. We have two nurses, two doctors in the whole ward. There's no food for the patients. So you actually stop people from getting help. And I'm sure many died in hospitals because they could not get oxygen and they couldn't get care. And in ICU, there was not enough people to take care of them. You harm the people that you said you're supporting. You destroyed the areas where people could buy food from. Now, they have to pay a much higher price and take fuel and go out to buy from somewhere else because the shops and the food is not available. And so it costs far more for people who are already in difficulty. You've destroyed practices and optometry practice of Black professionals. And you burn a pharmaceutical manufacturing plant. Those medicines benefit people, Black people and all people of all race groups. You're affecting pharmacies. For example, a pharmacy was affected in Dalton. That pharmacy is the only medical facility in a 45-kilometer radius. There's no clinic, there's no hospital. All ARV medication, all the other medication, all the medical supplies for the whole region comes from the one pharmacy. You've destroyed that pharmacy. And you've put at risk 150,000 jobs. Again, how are you helping the country? Any person who does that is surely a traitor. And then somebody who promotes racial violence to cause disturbance to get the end, obviously is harming the country. That cannot be a patriot. Patriots make peace. They make dialogue. They build a country. They fix things. They look at the welfare of everyone else in the country. They don't cause destruction, harm, and incite death and clashes.
Are you happy with the response by the government to the situation there?
No. It was a spectacular failure on the part of government. You know, you had, first of all, it shows that we have unintelligent services. How can anybody not know that this was taking place when down the road, where my old practice was, area said there was a lot of movement in the area where they were living. And people told them, soon we're going to be having a lot of stuff, a lot of goods in our houses. And they asked when. And they said, in a few weeks' time, we're going to be getting a lot of stuff from all. So the word was already out that something was taking place. If only people in the streets knew this, how come the intelligence services didn't know that? And then let's go one step further. If you knew you were going to incarcerate or take into custody, you know, an ex-president with so much of support. And I want to make it clear, I'm not saying that Zuma is behind all this kind. And I want to speak something about that also. That, you know what, you're saying that an ex-president, you know he's going to be taken, you know he's got support. You want to take him away. When you're going to do that, don't you think there's going to be a reaction and there's going to be a disturbance? Shouldn't you be preparing for it to make sure that you bring about stability and make sure it's taken in a decent way so there's no friction? To his credit, he went, you know, peacefully. Had Zuma resisted, there could have been a big fight and a bloodbath there. But were the security forces ready? Did they deploy troops? Did they deploy SCPS? No, they didn't do that. And go one stage further. If you know you're going to have unrest, how come your SCPS are not well armed? They don't have enough weapons. They don't have enough bullets. They don't have enough functioning vehicles. What kind of planning are you doing to deal with not only this situation, but any other situation? And then you act so many days later, you send the military in after the shops are destroyed. We're coming from an economy that's totally destroyed by COVID-19. And even before that, you know, we already downgraded our status. You know, we almost need junk status. So we need everything to preserve the economy. What kind of a message are you sending to the world? That the government of this country is incapable of providing peace and stability and exists on the sidelines while shopping centers and 40,000 businesses are affected at a time when we cannot afford to lose 50 billion rand. It's like taking government money and buying 50 billion rand of firecrackers and burning it. That's exactly what has happened. And you have shown no foresight in dealing with this. And then you have internal conflict between your ministers. It shows you don't know what's going on, you know, as a government. It's truly, I mean, it has caused such a lot of disillusionment among all sectors of society. And I mean, all colors, you know, not a specific race, all colors, because everybody is equally affected. I said about Zuma. We must make sure that we're very clear about what we say. We can't say that Zuma is behind this. And I say that not to defend him. I know Zuma personally. I've met him on many occasions. What I do know about him, and maybe I made a big misjudgment, but what I do know about him, that he won't want to spill blood in his name, that he won't want to harm citizens in this country in his name, and he won't want to harm, you know, the country as a whole in his name. And he's told me on many occasions, he said, Dr. Suleiman, people use my name. They say things that I don't say. And I have personal experience with that. Let me tell you, one day, I got a call from someone. I know who the person is. And the person said, the president says, don't feed the people in Marikana. Don't feed the people in Marikana, and they will stop fighting or they'll stop protesting. They will get hungry. So I said, the president knows my number. Tell him to call me himself. I want to hear that from his mouth. That never happened. And whenever I was with him, he always said, President Zuma hasn't brought you anything. The South African government hasn't brought you anything. The ANC hasn't brought you anything. The World Council hasn't brought you anything. The only people that have brought you something and is talking to the public is from Gift of the Givers. So please don't thank Zuma, don't thank the ANC, and don't thank the South African government. Thank Gift of the Givers and their donors. Wherever you went, you always saw goodwill with him. And whoever you speak to, who knew him well, know him as a warm-hearted person. I don't know if you read what Helen Ziller had to say about him when she mentioned that after she pinned the 782 charges or whatever against him, he still phoned her when she was out of the day to say it's lonely out there, isn't it? He is the one who offered the olive branch. After she pinned the 782 cases on him, when she was coming to a meeting with the premiers, she said she was the only non-ANC premier, and he phoned her to tell her, you know what, don't feel scared, don't be left out, it's all inclusive. So without defending him, we have to be very, very careful that we don't apportion the mayhem that's going on a person who may not be involved. And then we were told that on the 19th of July, they were going to go to escort and take him out of prison. Did anybody ask him? He wants to be broken out of prison. You want to come out like a common criminal? Did anybody ask him that? Nothing happened. And if he wanted to run away, why didn't he do that when he was released to go to his brother's funeral? That was a golden opportunity for all those people who said they're going to protect him and preserve him and take him out and make sure he's not in jail. Open opportunity at the funeral. You should have just taken your thousands of troops and taken away. Why did that not happen?
To what extent are you still involved in the aftermath of all this looting and drama that we've seen in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng?
We're on all the time. We haven't stopped from the first day. It happened on the 11th. In us, it happened actually where I am. That same night on the 11th of July, the Brookside Checkers, which is less than 2 kilometers from where I live, was started. The disruption started there. And strangely enough, that's another thing. When I was there that afternoon, I was there on the 11th of July on Sunday afternoon in the same Checkers. And the guys are coming to tell me, we're closing early today. And I thought they were closing because of curfew. Not striking me that curfew is only 10 o'clock. And the mall normally closes at 4 or 5 o'clock on a Sunday. So I said they're closing a little early today. It didn't strike me. I was relating that to COVID-19. And the guy from the Vodacom shop told me, we're removing all our cell phones. That he told me afterwards, not the same day. And they knew already that something was going to happen. How come again ordinary citizens knew, but the government didn't know? So that day when it happened, the next day already, we were involved. Well, on Monday, still there was not much drama. But on Tuesday, on the 13th, we started getting calls from a lot of people wanting milk for their children. And then the calls came, simple things like bread and milk. So by the 13th already, we were rolling out bread and milk. And by the 14th, when we got calls from hospitals to say we've got very few staff here, our doctors are worried that if something is made available and some shops are available, how can they purchase items? So we said, okay, we'll make that available to them. And we started rolling out food parcels to healthcare workers. And then hospitals called and they said, like I said in the beginning, there's no food for patients. So we started rolling out food to patients. So it was bread and milk, food parcels to healthcare workers, paramedics, frontline health workers, and then the food parcels to areas that were affected. And we started going far out, you know, all over KZN. But we had to change our system. Normally, we pack the food parcels ourselves, we load the trucks ourselves, we take it to the area ourselves, and we deliver it ourselves. Now you've got a province that's affected in every corner of the province. If you're going to do that yourselves, you know how long it's going to take to get food to people who are hungry. So we changed the system. Because we've got a fantastic network and people that we know all over the ground, people said, look, I got a truck. We say, okay, come, fetch the food parcels, fetch the items. Can you package it yourself and get it to the people who need it most? They say, we know exactly what to do, where to do, and who to give it to. So people who got trucks came and picked up food parcels. Other people said, we'll deliver it to you. Do you have volunteers, a warehouse spacing to make the food parcels yourself? They said, yes, we've got enough people. Send it to Ishawi, for example. We've got a big warehouse, you know, and we know so many different communities in different areas. We'll deliver it ourselves. So to increase the speed of distribution and delivery, also at the beginning, the problem was there was not enough fuel. My staff couldn't come to work. So 4 or 5 people only were doing the food parcels using small vehicles. You were scared stuck. You may be a target to be attacked, you know, for your vehicle or your warehouse. So you had to be circumspect in the beginning. But soon, after the 4th day, we took out all our trucks, all our staff came, and the supplies, fortunately, were available in KZN. We didn't have to bring anything from outside KZN. Everything was available locally. And from that day up till today, we've carried on delivering both in KZN to a less extent Gauteng, because Gauteng has not been that much affected compared to what has happened in our part of the world. And we've already reached close to 30,000 food parcels distribution. Besides, in addition to that, it was the hospitals, the healthcare workers, the paramedics, and then institutions, old age home, you know, orphanages, home for the physically and mentally challenged. They were in trouble even before all this started. What COVID-19, their funding had already started decreasing substantially. So they were already hungry. They were already in difficulty. So we made it a policy to start rolling out support in bulk to all these institutions. And the next phase, what was doing these things, is to support businesses that, you know, have collapsed, to put them back in business. And I'll give you one example. The first one we done was a pharmacy in Phoenix. Asked the guy, what do you need? He said, look, other people need more than me. I'm going to take my savings, family and friends. But if you give me between 10 and 20,000, I'm sure I'll be able to start. Everything was destroyed. He said, look, I'll get insurance. I said, when? He said, probably 2 months' time. So I said, how many staff you have? He says, 14. So he said, if I start in 2 months' time, it means 14 people will be without income, and himself and his family without income. I gave him basically 25,000 rand. And a week later, his pharmacy was open. 14 people were in business and are in working already, and it has started. In Mzinto, a lady who sells clothes, we gave her some new stock, and she's back in business. The pharmacy in Dalton, I spoke to you about, we've given it to some other companies who want to look at it to see how they can put a pharmacy back on its feet. Now, we're also renovating Glenda Gray, Professor Glenda Gray's Clip Town Clinic in Johannesburg. In Clip Town, it was affected. It's a research center, it's a clinic. My teams are on site right now, upgrading that clinic for Professor Glenda Gray, as well as putting in new equipment. And hopefully by Monday, that should be fully functional. There's a home for the physically and mentally challenged in Verulam that was severely destroyed. We're sending teams in and supporting them with equipment. Not only us, the other people also supporting it to put them back on their feet. And then we're looking at pharmacy practices. We're looking at opticians and other businesses, you know, both informal and formal one, and to see how we can help. And we're getting corporate companies coming forward to put up funding to upgrade businesses and to rehabilitate them.
Doctor, you are involved in this line of disaster right at the end. After the event, you get involved. So the problem where it starts is not really dealt with by you, rightly so, because you have a different task on your hands. But nevertheless, if you had the opportunity to make a difference, to make a suggestion of what should happen in terms of that political interaction in our country to actually alleviate some of these problems before we get to disasters.
Social cohesion is very important in our country. Right now, what is the main issue? It's economics. The fact that some people have and some people don't have. And also when you have a political party that's running a country and has got instability within itself, it starts there. A lot of plans. Look, the government's got fantastic policies. They've got a fantastic constitution. They've got grand ideas. But implementation is the big problem. And implementation is affected both at political party level, before it comes to government level, and of course, after ministerial level, there's conflict lower down with the civil servants. There's so many decision makers that there's conflict between directors, between director generals, between people in different departments that work together. Like for COVID-19, why didn't we have a centralized disaster facility that overrides health, water, trade, everything associated with the economy and health with COVID-19? We have different departments pulling in different directions. And I'll give you one classic example. So to answer your question, we have to have stability within the party itself. And a lot of this fear, unfortunately, is related to ego. It's related to ego, it's related to greed, it's related to personal benefit. There's no altruism, you know, and there's a lack of spirituality, morality, and ethics. All that we are suffering in government and outside the government, it's not restricted to the government, it's in the corporate world also. When we talk about corruption, you can only get corrupted in government if someone from outside comes to offer you that corruption. It's not merely you corrupting yourself. And we've seen what has happened over with big companies, you know, getting involved in government corruption. It doesn't come from government itself. So there is an intrinsic deficiency in spirituality, in morality, in ethics, in faith. And these are the things, if you address, you will see a difference. And a lot of that has come to the surface in the last 2 years since COVID-19 and what has happened now. And a lot of people are mentioning the same things. They want to have more experience with spirituality and how to bring about changes in character and personality and in behavior. So these are things where political parties have to look, not at them, what, because you come to the government for two reasons, either to benefit the country or benefit yourself. Right now, it looks like most of them are in to benefit themselves, not the country. So you need to be sure why you're going into power. That's a very important, you know, to me. I was coming back to what I told you about conflict. Now, the Department of Trade and Industry, Minister Ibrahim Patel, last year, says the country needs ventilators because we know there's a shortage worldwide. So what can South Africa do with its science and its technology? The National Ventilator Group is formed. They got engineers from all skills, and the SKA people, the telescope people, they get involved. They get 96 proposals. They water it down to 6. From the proposals, they design a phenomenal machine, the CPAP machine, which is most practical, most suited to our environment. CSIR manufactures these machines. SAHPRA registers them and authorizes them to be used for a limited temporary period on South African patients, specifically for COVID-19 for oxygen supply. Solidarity Fund pays for them. 20,000 machines, 12,500 each, 250 million there. Taxpayers' money, South African money, well spent. No issue with that. Machines are very well, are good, required for the country. Everybody did a good job. And then after that, the drama starts. The National Ventilator Group calls and says, we can't get these machines into government hospitals. I said, I don't understand. Then the government authorizes production of this machine. They said, yes, but we can't bypass the health system or work with the health system. We are being obstructed to get these machines into government hospitals. It was the peak of the second wave. People were dying in the car park, in casualty, on the farms, in their cars, in their homes. You know, in the wards, they were just dying. There was not enough oxygen delivery devices, and there was not enough oxygen. I said, give them to me. They gave us 2,500. In 10 days, we distributed 2,500 machines to several hospitals in 6 provinces. And I said, I'm not waiting for anybody's permission. We're going to do it. And 2 days later, we started getting the calls. For the first time this weekend, we didn't count any bodies. We've saved so many lives. Where were these machines? Why were they not brought to us? One government department couldn't get into another government department.
Doctor, what are the goals that you still wish that you can actually attain?
I'd like to see a stage where we don't have to help people in terms of poverty. I like to see a stage where everything's sustainable, where people are self-functioning, where we use money for development. I like to see all the hospitals in South Africa upgraded, because sometimes when people go to there's not, the buildings look, when you look at it, you think, am I going to get better here? psychologically it's a problem. I would love to see all the hospitals, government, corporates, international donors getting together, and we're busy with that right now. We are upgrading hospitals as best we can. We are upgrading schools as best we can. We're putting up boards in farming areas to save the sheep, to help the economy so farm workers can go back to work. You can generate economy. You can help the GDP 18%. So more boreholes, more fodder, more enriched pellets, sanitation at schools, more counseling services are required, putting more, paying for more doctors and pharmacists and nurses to study. And right now, the need of the hour is psychologists. There's trauma in every way, with the looting, with the COVID-19, with the economy, with job losses. And universities, out of 300 candidates, take 8 people for counseling psychologists, or, you know, 8 people for clinical psychologists. I don't understand the logic. Universities should be churning out students that are required for the needs of the country. You can't have 300 students and take only 8 or 10 people and say you become psychologists when there's a huge need in the country for psychologists right now. There's job creation. That's essential service. We put people to research and they study and they study and they study. And afterwards they come out from there with all that money spent and there's no job because it's irrelevant study. We need to relook at what's required by the country and fund those kind of things. So that when people, right now, we need doctors, we need nurses, we need dietitians, we need physios, we need paramedics, and we need psychologists. It's you don't need rocket science. It's a ready job to walk into. The government's been prepared to fund that and give the job. There's 40,000 posts that are not filled in hospitals. And then municipalities are totally underskilled. All the skill has left in municipalities. 227 municipalities in the country. You can put in engineers, you can put in technical guys, you can put in accountants. There's job creation. You'll spend money. But in the long run, you'll save a lot of money on infrastructure, on accounts, on governance, on corruption. You'll actually save much more money than you spend. And you'll improve the economy of the country, and the country itself will be on a stronger footing. So I would love to see all those kind of things taking place in South Africa. And more than anything else, I like to see social cohesion, a patriotic approach, and yes, what COVID-19 and the looting, there's been a great goodwill among all population groups to hold each other, to support each other, to strengthen each other, and say, we are, so this is social activism, where civil society is saying, we're taking control of the country to uplift each other and uplift ourselves in the interests of ourselves, our children, and future generations.
Dr. Suliman, thank you very much. Good luck and all of the best.
Thanks, Vivek. Thank you very much.